Well, I realized that I didn't introduce myself. My apologies. My name is Johnny Johnson. I'm the campus pastor here at Willowdale Jennersville, and we are very delighted that you've chosen to spend your Sunday morning here with us. And a few things before we get into the message, we just want to draw your attention to kind of a couple things that we have going on that are kind of exciting, and one leads right into the message. But the first, a few weeks ago, actually about a month ago, if you were here, you heard us talk about one of the things we were going to encourage the people of Willowdale to do this Christmas season, and that was to throw great parties. We want you to throw awesome parties this year, and here's why. And you'll see there's this Christmas party toolkit that we put together. When we look at the scriptures, it's not uncommon for us to see Jesus at a party, or Jesus at a meal, or Jesus interacting with people over a table or in some way that quite honestly doesn't look like this. It doesn't look like just church on a Sunday morning, because some people, their invitation to church might look like a longer road than say, hey, come on a Sunday morning. It might be intimidating. So we thought parties are a pretty easy way to invite people to come to things, specifically to your house. And so we put together this toolkit, and what we want you to do is we want you to throw a party at your house. But this party isn't just supposed to be for people from the church, or it isn't just supposed to be for other Christians who don't go to this church. The purpose of this party is for you to have a space to invite your friends, to potentially have them for the first time ever, maybe to meet other people from the church and just kind of start having fun and building relationships with each other. I'll tell you right now, I made this packet. If you pick it up, you're going to be like, this is nothing groundbreaking. It's not. The point of this is that it's supposed to be simple. It's supposed to be you like kind of just walking you through the steps of being like, hey, I'm a human being. How do I get together with some other human beings and have a party? Here's how you invite people, like things like that, and games, and what do you do about food, and all those things. But really, kind of the big piece that we would love to have you do, and this is going to feel different for each of you at each party, if you're willing to step up and have one of these parties, is at some point in the night, we would love for you to just say something very simple, 30 seconds or less, if you feel so moved to do so. Hey, you know, to everyone in your party, you know, we're so happy you chose to be here with us. It's Christmas. We just want to tell you why we celebrate Christmas. We celebrate the birth of Jesus, and we're really excited about that. You know, and kind of just tooling that out a little bit, and we'd love to have you come to one of our Christmas Eve services if you would be so bold to come and join us. We'll sit with you. We'd love to have you come. There's information about that in here. So we would love to have you pick one of these up. If you have a small group that you're in, would you consider maybe having your small group party actually be for the people in your group, but also for your neighbors? Or if there's a couple other families that are in this room right now or that you know go to the church, what would it look like to team up together? It's like, hey, let's throw a party. Who's going to host? Who's going to take care of food? Who's going to be a part of this? And if you want to be a part of something, but you're like, I want to have a party, but there's no way I am inviting people to my house, there's a table out there. You'll see a poster. You'll see this out there. We'd love for you to take a packet, but sign your name, sign your email up. If you even just want to be a part of a team of people who are starting to just figure out what this might look like. We just want you to invite people. We want you to have fun. We want them to know who Jesus is through the community of the church, and it starts with having people at your house. And so we thought Christmas, what a great time to do that. So if you'd be so bold, love to have you take one of these. There's some out there. There's a digital copy too. If you'd rather have it in digital, just send me an email. All that information's out there. But we're excited about this. Also, something else we want to draw your attention to. It's November, which you probably know, but we have been working up in the series called The Abundant Life, which we're going to talk about in a second. But we've been asking people to kind of take this gratitude challenge. There's some kind of science behind this. I don't know who the scientist is or what the research is behind it. But if you write down three things that you're grateful for a day, it actually has been found to have profound impact on your life. That's one of the reasons why if you saw all the post-it notes that are on the windows out there, we've been asking people to write something you're thankful for, slap it on the wall. You can do more each week. We'd love for you to grab three of those before you leave today, write them on there, slap them up on the glass before you go. And one of the other ways that we've been engaging people in that is we've been doing this little Willowdale, this says gratitude is affecting the Willowdale gratitude, hashtag Willowdale gratitude photo challenge. And every day of the month, we've been asking people to post pictures on social media of things that they're grateful for in specific categories. So for instance, yesterday, the day was, it was movement. So you're supposed to, something that you were grateful for that involved movement. People had dance on there. They had people running track. I posted a video of our 4-year-old drumming because that's a lot of the movement that happens at our house. And today's is technology. And so what does it look like for you to kind of realize what James says in the New Testament, that every good gift comes from above and to be grateful for that. So we'd love to have you join us in on this. These cards are out at the table, but at the least, you can write at least three things that you're thankful for out on there. And some of them are really funny. Someone wrote Post-its on a Post-it note and put it up on the glass. So hearty har, very funny. Someone also wrote Star Wars 7 and then posted it up as high as they possibly could in the middle of the glass. But something kind of cool that's happened through this is that there's a guy out at the Kennett campus who, whenever Greg introduced this sermon series, as I said, we're going to be talking about this Abundant Life series, he went home and he promptly wrote down 45 things that he was thankful for. And then from every day forward, since then, he's been writing three new things that he's grateful for every single day. And as we said, there's kind of a science behind this, that it's actually healthy and good for you to do this, to write it out. And he wrote Greg an email this week, and here's the list of some of the things that have happened to him over this time period. He said he's had relief from depression. He's substantially decreased anxiety, a strong desire to encourage others and actually doing more of it, and a way to strike up conversations about faith, 4 or 5 so far, and ability to tolerate pain more easily. That's amazing, isn't it? Now, just know that we're not saying this is kind of like a self-help thing and like, oh, now if you just go home and write 3 things down on a piece of paper. But there's something about recognizing that we have been blessed and given so much and us acknowledging that. Doesn't mean life's peachy all the time, right? I mean, look what just happened across over in Europe and what's happening in our world around us. But there's something cool about doing that and being a part of that. And so as I said, as we're doing all this, as we're doing the hashtag thing, the Christmas party thing, we're working through the Gospel of John in John chapter 10. Gospel of John is a story about Jesus' life. And in chapter 10, there comes this discourse where he starts teaching people. And he uses this verse. You'll see it underneath the screen there. It says, the abundant life. Jesus in John 10:10 says, I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. Another way to translate that is that they might have life to the full. And so we've been asking the question this month, what exactly does that abundant life look like? If Jesus said, I came so that they may have, that we may have this abundant life, what does that actually look like for us? What does that actually mean for us? And kind of something cool I came across this week, I read an article by a guy named David Brooks. You'll see his picture up here on the screen. David Brooks is an author for the New York Times. And he wrote this book called The Road to Character, and I actually found out about the book after I read the 3-page article, and I'm pretty sure I got the whole book in the 3-page article, which means I don't have to read the book, which is great. But the article was called The Moral Bucket Lists. And what Brooks said in this article, and I'm assuming where he gets to in the book, is that he said about once a month or every so often, he'll meet someone who he says radiates inner light. That there's just something about them that you can tell they're just a deeply good person, that they listen well, that they help other people. And he said kind of one of the defining marks of someone who radiates inner light is someone who obviously is putting other people before them. And so Brooks talked about, he said, you know what, when I meet someone like this, it just brightens my day. It just makes my day better. And so he has kind of this euphoria, this high of happiness. But then he says he's equally met with almost an equally sad and depressed kind of feeling at the same time, because he realizes, from Brooks' words, he said, I am not that person. Man, that person's great, but I am not that person. In fact, it's kind of depressing to me that I'm not that person. What is it about them that makes them like that? And so the journey that he went on, and where this book came from, is he said, you know, I'm going to figure out what it looks like to be one of these people, one of these people who radiates inner light and just kind of like helps other people and everyone around. And he went on what he called moral adventures. He has a list of things. I mean, there's different character traits that he comes up with. And so I think he actually lived out, okay, what would someone who was like this, what would they do? And he lived that adventure out in hopes of being one of those people. Now, in that whole process, he came to discover 2 categories of virtues. He says that there are virtues that we all try to live out. He said one category of them could kind of be called resume virtues, and the other category would be called eulogy virtues. So there's resume virtues and eulogy virtues. Here's what he says about resume virtues. These are the good things that people do, but they're the good things people do to kind of pad their resume. You know, it's the classes that you take. It's the degree that you have. It's the job that you have, or whatever it is. You know, so-and-so has a great resume. Or if you're a student looking to go to college, you might try to do things maybe that will look good on your college application. Whether or not, you know, you might be in 6 different clubs, but you might not care about any of them, but it looks good on an application. So we have these virtues, and it's kind of these resume virtues. But then there's also these things that he calls eulogy virtues. And what eulogy virtues are these are the things that people would say about you at your funeral. Were you kind? Were you faithful? Were you brave? Were you honest? Were you capable of not only giving but receiving love? And so Brooks is quick to note, he's quick to note which one is more important. He says, you know, we all realize that one of these is more important than the other. In the long run, which is more important? The eulogy virtues, right? Good. That was a test. But he says that everything in our world seems to kind of build us up and equip us to have good resumes, right? But the thing is that these eulogy virtues are the things that we need to strive after and we need to go after. It's kind of weird that we are able in our world, whether it's in schools or at our jobs or whatever, we're really good at building a career, but we're not necessarily great at building inner character. Now, I want you to just kind of process through this with me because we're talking about this abundant life and think about these resume virtues, these eulogy virtues, and this abundant life in our world. Typically, when we think about having an abundant life, we're typically going to think about someone who might have more of those resume virtues, right? Maybe they have the job. They have the house in the right neighborhood with all the right things inside of it, with the right car, and they have the wife and the kids and whatever else you would think that kind of would go along with having that good resume. Now, nothing wrong with those things in and of themselves, but those can't be the end. But having these eulogy virtues, which is what Brooks talks about and what we're going to get into here in just a little bit, it kind of seems like that's the way to go. But at the same time, most of the people in our world, and even if we're honest to us, at sometimes, well, it seems foolish to live out of those virtues and to strive for those things. In fact, the number one thing that Brooks kind of says is that you have to kind of look at everything, and the one you want to strive after the most is humility. Humility, humbling yourself. And quite honestly, someone who maybe is all about just kind of focused on pushing the resume virtues, they might not be very humble. Well, they might write it on their resume, but they may not be very humble. Now, today we're going to look at a story and some words that Jesus says when he's talking to Pharisees. He's talking to these very religious people who are very concerned about specific things and the things that Jesus is and is not doing. And Jesus, he essentially gets into this whole dialogue, and we're going to see that what Jesus pushes is something that would fit more into the category of one of our eulogy virtues. See, Jesus isn't necessarily concerned about our resume virtues. He's concerned about the eulogy virtues. He's concerned about these good things that, to use Brooks' language, help radiate inner light from someone. And so we're going to read in John 10, verses 11 through 18. And we're gonna back up, and then we'll kind of dissect it a little bit. But just so you know, the verse that comes right before this is the verse that our whole series is kind of hinged around. I have come that they may have life, and that they might have it abundantly. Or I have come that you might have life, and that you might have it to the full. Right after Jesus says that, we get into what we're going to read. And he gives us this beautiful picture of about why he came and what it actually means and what it looks like for us to have this abundant life, what it means for Jesus because of that. So if you'll join me, you'll see them on the screen. You can read along silently. You don't have to read along out loud, unless you want to, but that'd be weird. Verse 11, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The hired hand is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep. So when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. Then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. The man runs away because he is a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me, just as the Father knows me and I know the Father. And I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep that are not of this sheep pen. I must bring them also. They too will listen to my voice, and there shall be one flock and one shepherd. The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life, only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. This command I received from my Father. So just a few important things we want to follow along with here. Well, first of all, so Jesus builds up to this, right? So he's talking in John 10, he's interacting with these Pharisees, and there's all this kind of like sheep shepherd language going on. He talks about that the sheep know his name. and they hear his voice. And then he talks about how he's the gate and he's the way actually into heaven. He's the way there. And then he kind of comes up to this point where he says, I've come that they may have life and they may have it abundantly. And then he goes into this discourse about being a good shepherd. Now, something we need to realize before we move forward here is that there's something very specific, one of these eulogy virtues that Jesus is all about, and it's the mark of the good shepherd. And that mark of the good shepherd that we want to focus on here this morning is one word, and it's sacrifice. We hear over and over again, and we'll see this as we look at the text a little bit more, that the good shepherd is the good shepherd because he sacrifices himself, that he lays down his life, it says, for the sheep. And so I think to help us understand that, I want to go back and I just want to pull some things out of this text that I think will help us wrap our minds around what this means for us and also what it means for our world and everyone around us. So first thing I want to focus on, just the first two words of the passage that we read, I am. Now you might be wondering why that's significant, because that these two words seem pretty insignificant, right? This is just like how you introduce someone. Hello, I am Johnny. And that's how you introduce yourself. But there's something deeper here. There's something more going on with these two words. We want to jump back to the book of Exodus. We're going to go back to the Old Testament. And there's this guy named Moses. We probably have all heard of the name Moses. Moses is the guy we think about around Easter time because they play the Ten Commandments on ABC, you know. But Moses is the Moses who led the Israelites out of slavery. The let my people go Moses, the Ten Commandments Moses. And so at this point, though, and what we're going to look at in just a second, Moses is out and he's shepherding his father-in-law Jethro's flock. And the Israelites, God's people, are back in Egypt. And they've been in slavery for hundreds of years. And God comes to Moses and he says to him, Moses, I've heard the cries of my people. And I'm going to release them from slavery. I want to deliver them from slavery, but I want you to go. I want you to be my mouthpiece. I want you to be the one who goes to Pharaoh and says, essentially, let my people go, and part of that whole process. And if you know the story of Exodus, there's the 10 plagues, and there's the whole deal that comes out of that. But one of the things that Moses does is Moses is a stutterer. Moses kind of comes up with excuses. He comes up with different reasons for him not to go and do this. And one of the excuses he comes up with is he says, okay, well, what if I go to the Israelites, to the people who are in slavery, and say to them, you're going to be delivered from slavery. I'm the one, I'm the mouthpiece. I'm the one who's here that's going to help make this happen. God's going to do it, but I'm here with you. And what if they say to me, okay, well, who sent you? You know, Mr. Moses, who sent you? Who's the one who sent you? Essentially, what Moses is asking them, he says, well, okay, what am I supposed to tell them? Who sent me? What is your name? Moses is asking God for his name so that he's able to tell the Israelites who has sent him to do this. And here's how God answers him in 3:14 of the book of Exodus. He says, I am who I am. This is what you are supposed to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. I am who I am. This whole idea of just I am. One word in Hebrew, the grammatical construction of it, it's a tetragrammaton, which doesn't mean anything to you, but what it means is that that what God is saying here is I always have been, I am presently, and I always will be. And so when we get to the Gospel of John and we have Jesus saying, I am the good shepherd, this is not the only time that he uses that I am structure. In fact, he says it seven times about himself in seven different ways in the Gospel of John. I am the good shepherd. I am the gate. I am the bread of life. I am the living water. And when he's doing this, this I am is actually a very personal name for God. And so the people listening to him saying this would know, and the people reading this back then would know that there's something more going on here with Jesus. You see, Jesus, because it's a personal name for God and he's saying, I am, he's taking on that identity. He's saying, I have this power. I have this authority. I am God. I am his son. So he starts off this whole discourse, this part of it, with a pretty bold statement. He's saying, I am. And then he goes on to say, I am the good shepherd. So what does that mean, that he's the good shepherd? The word good here, it's a Greek word. There's different words in Greek you could use that translate good. One of them is the word agathos. And agathos means moral goodness, moral quality. That if someone's a good person, they're a nice person, you would say, man, that is an agathos kind of person. But this is not the word good that's used here. The Greek word that gets translated good in this passage is the word kalos. And what that word means is that it still means good, obviously, because it gets translated good, but it means that there's a certain charm about this goodness that makes it lovely. This is goodness that's attractive. This is goodness that actually draws people to him. This isn't just, oh, you're a good person. This is, there's something more going on here. There's something about this I am, who is this good, this kalos good, that draws people in, that makes them lovely, that makes them attractive, not like woo-woo attractive, but there's something about him that pulls people in towards him. And then, of course, he calls himself the good shepherd. Shepherd was an Old Testament, it was a very common Old Testament, and the Israelites would know this, picture for God, God and his people. You know, just think about Psalm 23. Even if you haven't been around church for forever, you all potentially heard this at a funeral, the Lord is my shepherd, right? Ezekiel 23 is a very, or 23, that's so off, 34. Those aren't even the same numbers. Ezekiel 34 is this famous kind of Old Testament chapter where God talks about, you would read in Ezekiel that the Israelites, and he says, the sheep, my people have been scattered, and these other shepherds have kind of scattered them out, and they're all over the place, but I, the good shepherd, will come, and I will gather them up. And so not only is Jesus saying that I am, taking that identity of God, the good, the kalos, the one that draws people into him, but I am that good shepherd. I am. He's drawing that picture again that he is God. And the shepherd is the one who comes after the sheep. And we see here very specifically that the shepherd is the one who lays down his life for his sheep. That's what makes him good. That's what makes him attractive. That's what makes people drawn to him. And then he also contrasts himself here, though, with this hired hand. You know, he says, the hired hand is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep. So when they see the wolf coming, they run. They skedaddle. You know, think, for the sake of the illustration, think that this is kind of, this might be someone who's not only a false shepherd, but someone who might be more after the resume virtues, right? Oh, I'll add shepherding to my list of things. Oh, there's trouble. Out of here. But he contrasts, he is not that shepherd. He is this good shepherd. And we start to realize what's important to this good shepherd. It says that he lays down his life for his sheep. But then when we jump up to the next couple verses, we see here that he says it again in verses 14 and 15. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father. And I lay down my life for the sheep. The good shepherd, he repeats it. That means if it's repeated, it's important. Parents, if you repeat something to your children, that means it's important. That means you want them to get it. If you're at work and you're going through a training, there's probably a part where you're like, why do you keep saying that over and over again? That's because it's important. Jesus is saying here, I am the good shepherd. It's important. But then he says again, I lay down my life for the sheep. The mark of the shepherd is what? Sacrifice. Laying down his life, putting the sheep in front of him, making the sheep more important than himself. And we start to realize that this whole laying down the life thing is actually pretty important, because look at the last two verses of what we read. The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. This command I receive from my Father. Five times in these verses, in these short verses, Jesus points out the fact that the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Now, real quick, you could read this first section of this verse, the reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life only to take it up again. You could read this and you could almost kind of think, okay, well, does that mean that with the Father, would he not love the Son if he didn't lay his life down? It seems kind of conditional, right? Like, okay, well, the reason he loves me is because I do this. But I'm gonna kind of rework this with you just a little bit. If I could rephrase this passage, if I could rephrase this idea of this passage even a little bit, I would say it something like this. For God so loved the Son, the shepherd, and he so loved the sheep, his people, his world, that out of that deep double love, that the Father is thrilled when the shepherd, when the Son is willing to lay down his life for the world. The Father is thrilled whenever he does that, because the mark of the good shepherd is sacrifice. And the reason the Father is thrilled because of that, and here's kind of an important piece, that yes, there's sacrifice, yes, he lays it down, but this is not the end of the story, because not only does it say he lays his life down, but you'll notice that he says it twice here, that he also takes it back up again. He takes it back up again, and here's what that means. That on the front side of the cross, as we said, there's sacrifice. On the front side of the cross for Jesus, there's pain, there's suffering, it's horrible, it's awful, there's agony, and in some ways it looks like there's going to be defeat to those who are there watching. On the front side of the cross, the good shepherd has to lay down his life. But on the backside of the cross, we have resurrection. On the backside of the cross, we have the fact that the Son has authority to take it back up again. That means that, yes, the cross is kind of this awful fate that Jesus had to face, but it is not the end. It's actually his mission. It is Jesus' Son-accepted, Father-given mission for the world, that he would take on this sacrifice, that he would lay his life down, but he would also have the authority, God's authority, to raise it up again. So that if we believe that, that it's not just a sacrifice, it's not just the agathos, oh, you're a good person, you do something nice for someone, but this is the part, this raise it back up, this resurrection life that actually makes Jesus this kalos, this good, this appealing, this charming, this attractive goodness that draws other people to him. And a few chapters later, Jesus says, when I am raised up, I will draw all people to myself. When he's raised up with that sacrifice, when he's raised up, when he takes his life back up again. And so there's something deeper. There's something more going on here. You see, because of this, because of Jesus' mission, because of the fact that he does what the Father asks him to do, this is the only reason why we're able to read these words in Philippians, of just a book down the road in the Bible, a few books down the road, and we read these words of Jesus about Jesus in Philippians chapter 2, who, talking about Jesus, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used on his own advantage. Being in the very nature of God, he is the I am, right? He is the good shepherd. He is the one. He has that identity. He is God in the very nature of God. Did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness and being found in appearance as a man. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. That has a good shepherd written all over it, doesn't it? He humbled himself, even though he was like God. He became one of us, the nature of a servant, the nature of a slave, and he died a death on a cross. That's the mission of the Good Shepherd. That's the mark of the Good Shepherd. It's sacrifice. But it's not just the end. That's not the end. There's resurrection, and there's life in Jesus. There's a guy named Philip Keller who wrote a book, and some of you might be familiar with this because we did a series on it about a year and a half or a year and three quarters or so ago, at Psalm 23. Philip Keller, the book's called A Shepherd Looks at Psalm 23. Philip Keller grew up in East Africa, and he was, for 8 years, he was a shepherd in the flock in the field, and years later, he was a lay pastor at a church. And so they were teaching through this, and he thought, you know what, I have some experience being a shepherd. Psalm 23 is the one that we quoted earlier, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. So he kind of wrote his reflections about what it means to be a shepherd and read something like Psalm 23 and what that means for us. And Keller talked a little bit in here about the first time that he ever got his first group of sheep. And it's going to be a little lengthy, but I want to read this for you because I think it's important for us here this morning and what it means for the good shepherd who knows his sheep to come and lay his life down for them. So it'll be up on the screen there. Here's what he says. He says, I recall quite clearly how in my first venture with sheep, the question of paying a price for my ewes was so terribly important. They belonged to me only by virtue of the fact that I paid hard cash for them. It was money earned by the blood and sweat and tears drawn from my own body during the desperate grinding years of the Depression. And when I bought that first small flock, I was buying them literally with my own body, which had been laid down with this day in mind. Because of this, I felt in a special way that they were in very truth a part of me, and I a part of them. There was an intimate identity involved, which, though not apparent on the surface to the casual observer, nonetheless made those 30 ewes exceedingly precious to me. The good shepherd realizes that the sheep are important. The sheep are important. They're exceedingly precious to the shepherd. We, as sheep, are exceedingly precious to the shepherd. That is why he lays his life down. But this also has something significant for us. And I want to continue. Keller talks a little bit more a few pages later about what this means for his sheep also. The day I bought my first 30 ewes, my neighbor and I sat on the dusty corral rails that enclosed the sheep pens and admired the choice, strong, well-bred ewes that had become mine. Turning to me, he handed me a large, sharp killing knife and remarked tersely, "Well, Philip, they're yours. Now you'll have to put your mark on them." I knew exactly what he meant. Each shepherd has his own distinctive earmark, which he cuts into one of the ears of his sheep. In this way, even at a distance, it is easy to determine to whom the sheep belongs. It was not the most pleasant procedure to catch each ewe in turn and lay her ear on a wooden block, then notch it deeply with a razor-sharp edge of the knife. There was pain for both of us. But from our mutual suffering, an indelible lifelong mark of ownership was made that could never be erased. And from then on, every sheep that came into my possession would bear my mark. So not only does the good shepherd lay his life down for his sheep and have this relationship where he deeply loves his sheep, this also means something important for us. If we would claim to be Christians, if we would say that, yes, Jesus is my good shepherd, you see, there's also a defining mark for us. This is one of the things that helps leads us to the abundant life. And a defining mark of the sheep is actually that same of the shepherd, sacrifice. I want to go back to Philippians 2, those passages we just read, these amazing passages of what Jesus did and the very nature of God, did not consider equality with God. But I want to back up to what the first five verses that come right before those verses to tell us about the amazing sacrifice that Jesus made and what that means for him. Here's what Paul says in Philippians 2, 1 through 5. "Therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and of one mind." Look at this. "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interest, but each of you to the interest of the others. In your relationship with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus." And then he goes on to say, "who being in the very nature of God did not consider equality with God something to be used to his advantage." You see, a defining mark of the shepherd is sacrifice. But that also means that when we realize that and when we would say Jesus is my shepherd, that also means that sacrifice becomes a defining mark of us as well. That we are to put others before us. And I think one of the weirdest, hardest things about this abundant life is that actually an important part of experiencing that abundant life from Jesus that he said that he came to give involves you being willing to sacrifice for others. You being willing to say that other people are more important than me. Whether that's at work or at your home, with your family, with people that are hard to sacrifice for. This is a defining mark of the sheep. That we are marked by the shepherd with his sacrifice, knowing that we also are to sacrifice for others. And here's the cool thing about that. Other people, when they see you sacrificing, when they see you living out of that sacrifice, modeling what Jesus did for us, they see God. They see Jesus's work. They see you doing what he did. And as you live like that, you may have the opportunity one day to say to people, "You know what? Well, here's why I do this. Let me tell you about Jesus. Here's why I sacrifice. Here's why I put other people before me. Here's why I do that." You may be privileged and honored someday to do that if you live this sacrificial style of life. And here's the truth. David Brooks was right, wasn't he? At some level. That there are certain people, and those people that make you feel good about yourselves, those people that look like they're living that abundant life, again, our language around his story, are the people who put other people before themselves. And as much as I love that idea, David Brooks' idea, this eulogy virtues, the resume virtues, the inner light thing, there's one piece of his article that kind of made me just kind of stop and back up and be like, here's where I would maybe say this differently. But here's what he says as he's talking about becoming one of these people. "A few years ago, I realized that I wanted to be a bit more like those people, the people who radiate inner light. And I realized that if I wanted to do that, I was going to have to work a lot harder to save my own soul. I was going to have to work a lot harder to save my own soul. And when I read something like that, I say, you're so close. You're so close. Because yes, it is sacrifice. Yes, it is humility. Yes, it is considering other people better than yourself. But here's the deal. You don't get this abundant life. You don't get to be a part of that life of sacrifice by trying harder. In fact, you experience that abundant life by giving up. You experience that abundant life by turning your life over to that shepherd. I mean, look what Jesus says in the book of Matthew. He's talking to his disciples about his death. And he says, then Jesus said to his disciples, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. It's not about trying harder. It's about denying yourself, taking up your cross, following me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. Hey, that's hard, right? You want to build up your resume virtues? You want to try to save your life? You will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? What can anyone give in exchange for their soul? It's not about you trying harder. If you want to have this abundant life, if you want to live this life of sacrifice, the first thing you have to do is be willing to sacrifice your life over to Jesus and say, you are the good shepherd. You are the one who needs to guide my steps. You are the one who needs to lead me. You are the one who actually has to shepherd me in the direction that I need to go. We can't be concerned about ourselves. We can't be in self-protection mode. There's a lady this week, or pretty soon, I don't know if it's this week, but is going to get baptized at a Celebrate Recovery out on Monday nights out in the Kennett campus. And Carol Hoy, who's one of our women's directors on staff, happened to run into this lady a few weeks ago out in the lobby of the Kennett campus. And this woman, it was by chance, literally, this woman just kind of was there and said, hey, I have a, is this person here? Is this person here? No. Well, what do you need? Well, I have a question about God. And Carol said, well, maybe I can help you. And so she said, okay, well, I want to know how to become a Christian. That's like a, here you go. And Carol said, well, I can help you with that. And so they went into the worship center and they prayed together. And this woman accepted Christ and she's going to get baptized. She's going to make that public proclamation of her faith in Jesus. But here's a quote from this woman. Here's what she said. I used to be in such self-protection mode. I was just scared and guarded all the time. But now I feel what? Free. She feels that abundant life because she sacrificed her life. She gave it over to the Good Shepherd. She's now free to love. She's free to serve. She doesn't have to be in self-protection mode, only worried about herself. Yes, we do worry about ourselves, but yes, God will take care of us. But we can be free when we realize that not only does the Good Shepherd, not only is his mark sacrifice, but we are also called to sacrifice for others. But the only way we can do that is if we first sacrifice our lives to Christ. That if we're willing to say, you are the one who guides me, you are the one who leads me beside still waters, leads me on paths of righteousness. And the Good Shepherd invites you to be in that flock. And so today we want to invite you to be a part of that. The Good Shepherd lays down his life for you. Are you willing to accept that? Will you join me in prayer? Father, we are grateful for your word. God, we're grateful for this picture that we might not necessarily understand about what it means to be a shepherd and sheep. But God, we do understand the idea of a shepherd leading his sheep. And so, Father, we just ask that you would lead us. God, we ask that you would be the one who controls us. God, that you would be the one that when we look at you, we see this life of sacrifice. Lord, would you help us to model that to the world around us. But Father, may we do that not just out of being a good person, out of this moral quality of goodness, God, but may we do this living out of a goodness that comes from you, a goodness that comes from the sacrifice that you made, a goodness that comes from the life that we can only receive because of your resurrection, the fact that you raise up your life. And God, may that goodness draw people to you. May that goodness be of a charm, of a quality that's lovely and draws people into you. And Father, may you give us words as we sacrifice for others around us. Would you give us the words to let people know who you are? Father, for some of us, we need to realize today that you are the good shepherd and that you have come for us, that you have come for the sheep. Father, help us to know that. Help us to realize that. God, we're grateful for you. We love you. We pray these things in your name. Amen.